And welcome to Meathead Chatter, episode 42. Today, I have Alex Bromley with me. How's it going, man?
It's going great, man. How are you doing?
Super stoked to have you on the show, man. I'm pumped. I've been fanboying your YouTube for the past like 6 months. Very, very fun channel. Very, very cool videos. Very good knowledge dumps.
I appreciate that, man.
Yeah. So anyone who doesn't know, up front, you can follow him on Instagram at Bromarama on Instagram.
it's pretty close.
What is it? Bromarama.
Bromarama. It's a play on my name.
That makes much more sense than what I was trying to do. And I will also include that in the description too, as well as link to the YouTube channel you all should definitely watch. Okay, now on to cool stuff. What's your history, man? I saw you definitely were pretty big and strong, man, for a minute. So just go a little bit into your background, you know, develop that meathead credentials.
Yeah, sure thing. I actually don't talk about it that much. So it's always fun for me to kind of relive my glory days, because so much of my channel is about kind of helping general people navigate strength culture. I don't think most of the people on my channel really know a lot about my competitive glory days. And a lot of it probably isn't super relevant to the types of topics we cover. But I got into lifting when, I mean, like so many people, I was young, I was overweight, I wanted to do something. I never played sports. So I took a big leap and jumped into football when I was, God, I think it was like 13. And super uncoordinated, no predisposition to any athletic quality whatsoever. All of that still stands today. but I am a bit stronger and have a bit more muscle. So I just gravitated towards lifting because while I was getting knocked out on the field and I was dropping footballs and I, you know, was tripping over my own feet, it was cool to be able to go into the gym and see that progress, you know, stack up workout to workout, year after year. And by the time I was a senior, I was actually okay on the field, just by virtue of being stronger. And then right. I ended up pursuing competitive goals after high school. So we're looking at, I graduated 2003. So YouTube didn't exist. I don't believe Instagram or any of the other big social media platforms were really a thing at that point. Right. And I remember having a hell of a time trying to find anything. Like I didn't know what powerlifting was. I knew that there were like rumors of this place where, you know, people would go and watch you lift and judge your lift, but it was all right. Like mysterious to us, right?
Dude, it was crazy like that too, because I'm like same era as you. I graduated college in 2004, so I'm just like a touch older. But yeah, people don't understand how much of an information desert it was out there for lifting. It's like too much information now probably, but back then, I mean, you had, you know, later on you had Power Magazine, you had some like Powerlifting USA magazines, but it was like magazines that you got once a month. It wasn't anything else really.
Completely. I bodybuilding mags was
right.
Was my main source of knowledge. And I would just hope and it was cool because every now and then they'd have a centerfold or a feature of a powerlifter, a strongman.
Right.
And that was actually some of my first introduction into like specific strength culture. Would be like, they have like Mark Filippi, like, oh, strength right. coach from University of Las Vegas, world strongest man competitor. And he'd have something in there, or they'd have a feature from, you know, Equipped Powerlifting was massive back then. I don't right. think they had raw divisions separated out. So there'd be a lot of stuff. You know, Westside was becoming more popular. I remember seeing a lot of stuff from Equipped Ventures. They were on all the supplement sponsorships.
Yep.
So you see the guys in the triple fly shirts with the 1,100 pounds on the bar, Lang, Canelli, whatever, you know, back in the mid-2000s. And that was my only exposure to it, but finding good information. I mean, I remember the first time I found a Powerlifting USA, it was like at a Borders.
Right.
When Borders still existed, I'm like, what is this? And I just started pouring over it. And I think that's actually why Strongman became my first influence, was because I had seen World Strongest Man.
Right.
I made a point to TiVo it back when, God, I'm dating myself so much.
God, TiVo's.
I had VHS tape recordings.
Dude, you're just like blast TiVo from recordings. The past. I'm like, I identify so much with this era that you're talking about. It's fun to talk to someone that's like in the similar age genre as me.
Yeah, I mean, we take for granted, right, that everything's on demand.
Right.
I remember my dad telling me when I was younger, he's like, in the future, we'll be able to watch what we want when we want without commercials. I'm like, that's not a thing.
Right.
It's weird to, like, look back. It's like, no, we really did have to watch the commercials. We really did have to record things on VHS tapes. Feels like I'm, you know, it feels like this might as well be a century ago.
You had to rush home from school to watch the show you wanted to watch because it was starting whether you were there or not. Like,
uh-huh. If you missed it, you were SOL, boy.
Uh-huh.
So that was my first introduction, I think, was watching World's Strongest Man and making sure every Christmas, I didn't care if we were eating, I didn't care what was going on, I'd have to go watch it, and I ended up recording it. And I was so enamored with it because I was the only outlet for competition
right.
that involved this thing I love to do, lifting, that existed past, you know, high school football. So, and I sure as hell wasn't going to try to play like college football or something, like
right.
an abysmal athlete. I cannot stress enough. So I found my first contest. I think I was 19 the first time I competed. And I've been training like very, very consistently.
Now, was that in powerlifting or was that strongman?
Strongman was my first competition.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So 2006, I was 19. Talked my mom into driving me up to Clovis, California from the Inland Empire. It was, I believe it was on the order of like a 5 or 6 hour drive. It was not close.
Right.
And it's funny, California is a state with 40 million people. We had to go up to the middle of nowhere to find a strongman contest. Back then there were no women's divisions, and it wasn't, you know, people might shake their fist at the sky and say the patriarchy. There were just women didn't like,
they didn't do it. Yeah.
It was such a weird. Yeah. So there would be a couple women that would try to host events, and it was so, you know, when things are new, you get one or two people, it's not enough to justify, but you still have to have people. You still have to have those events in order to gain traction. Kristen Rose is a good, good friend of ours. She was a World's Strongest Woman for a long time.
Yeah. Started around Mike Westerling. Coached me a lot. He was her coach for a long time.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. And Mike's coached a lot of good people. I talked to Andrew Clayton recently, you know, he coached Clayton for a long time. Yeah. I recommend Mike's book too. That's a
great
really
read.
Good source of information. Anybody wanting to get into strongman, check out Mike's stuff. Kristen, I remember 06, 07, she had to compete heads up with the guys and she did well. You know, so that's kind of the early start of the sport, back when we were all a bunch of knuckleheads in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, there was,
counterculture.
231 and under and 231 and over. So if you're 240, you get to go against the 300-pound guy. I remember those days.
Completely, yeah. And I'm a hot take, man. I would gladly go back to those days. I winced at the increase of the weight classes in the divisions. I understand. You know, they're necessary, brings in a lot of people. But back then, it really was like you had to rise to the occasion. Well,
no one was a baby back then. They're like, oh, I might be able to hit that. I might not. But it's just the thing I have to hit. I'm dealing with that a little bit right now with some of my clients that have a show coming up that are nervous about it. I'm like, dude, it's so much nicer than back when I started. You're just count your blessings and go try, you know?
Don't you feel like a condescending prick, like trying to tell people how easy they have it? Like you have novice divisions, all the weights are scaled back.
Right. You know, but like you said, it's good. It's good for the sport because it's definitely helping grow it. Because there is an entry level, you can do novice, but still, you know, us curmudgeonly old men are just like, oh, back in my day, uphill both ways in the snow. You know, it's that kind of thing.
There's certainly trade-offs. There's no doubt about that. And the fact that I think the rise in popularity of the sport is because it is made more accessible. But on the other hand, it's not, these shows aren't the spectator sport that we think of them as being.
Right.
So I think everybody thinks that when they put on a show, it's like, oh, this is a microcosm of World's Strongest Man. And it's not. People will stop by and be like, oh, that's interesting. What's going on? But to follow what's going on in an entire show, you need editing. You need everything condensed into the half hour TV where there's the drama and the interviews and whatever. Besides that, it's a lot of people, you know, and it's great. We have a great time. We're in a parking lot. But there's limited viewer attention span, I think, that goes to all of those things going on.
Yeah,
and that's a problem with the bigger shows.
What are your thoughts on, because I remember just, I competed in Strongman pretty regularly for 2012 to, I don't know, up until a couple years ago. And I remember kind of, everybody complaining about, like, there not being a live stream for World's Strongest Man and all this stuff, but whenever there was one, no one tuned in, because, like you said, it's boring. Like, what's your take on, like, you know, the TV-produced World's Strongest Man, kind of how the Shaw Classic's going? Like, what's kind of your feeling on those from, like, a fan-spectator side? Because, really, the biggest thing that's going to make the sport grow is people who don't do the sport thinking it's interesting enough to watch.
Completely. Yeah, that's something a lot of strength athletes miss. I talk a lot about the unique dynamic of strength sports in regards to regular sports, because I don't think a lot of people really dwell on the difference. NFL, MLB, team sports, things that are spectator sports, are driven because they're fun to watch. So you get a fan base that likes watching it for the sake of watching it, regardless of whether or not they do it.
Right.
And because of that, you now have advertising. Now you have advertising. You can pay athletes just a whole hell of a lot of money. You can
recruit
the best talent. You can expand the divisions. These sports are exactly inverted. They are propped up by the people that participate. So it's a recreational sport, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's just a
right.
different business model. So I think there does seem to be an expectation from a lot of people that when they do have a big show, something we on the inside consider a big show,
right.
that obviously eyeballs are going to be on it, people are going to watch it. And it's like, no, like Worlds, like I love Worlds. Worlds is one of the, not the Worlds, big Worlds. I mean, the Worlds for, like, you know, we get the scraps when you're in a weight class or
right.
a Masters or whatever. But going to World's Strongest Man for, like, the weight classes, for the 105s, for the women and the Masters, It's a great show. Huge talent. When I competed in 2019, there were people from Poland and Australia and Africa, all of it. Like, it was a genuinely the highest level show you could think of for all these classes. International was great. Completely unwatchable. And I say that as somebody who loves this stuff.
Right.
And it's just because you can't have that many divisions. You can't have that many people, especially with the turnover of athletes. It's rare to get the same group of athletes mm-hmm. in each contest. So yeah, monetize. And by the way, like Laurent Chalet, and he has a guy he co-hosts with that he comments at OSG at the Worlds events. He does a fantastic job. He does so much to make it engaging. It's still unwatchable.
Right.
So you do have to have edit. If you want to package it, you do have to be able to make it appealing to other people. And it's the same recipe as like what ABC would do or what any network television network would do when they were trying to take a competition and sell it to, you know, a general family. It's just, it requires a little bit of work.
100%. Like, the production side matters more than the performance side, almost.
Go ahead.
You're good. I was just going to say, you look at World's Strongest Man, like, how many people have seen a powerlifting meet that are normal people? Not many, unless, like, their husband uh-huh. or wife or whoever, their buddy does it, and they'll go and be bored for 8 hours. And the same is true with Strongman, but I've yet to meet someone in the real world where I'm like, they're like, oh, what do you do? And I'm like, oh, you know, I compete in strongman. They're like, what's that? I was like, oh, you ever watched on TV with the Atlas Stones and the ball? They're like, oh, that, yeah. Like, everybody knows what World's Strongest Man is. And I feel like the athletes on the inside, the athletes / fans, are like, oh, you know, we're annoyed because we have to wait till December to, like, watch the full production, blah, blah, blah. But it's like, dude, if you want it to grow, like, that production value is why people even know it's a thing.
Yeah. It's really tricky because you see in real time is, like, people are trying to navigate the unique demands of the sport, the way it's structured
right.
to find that right answer. And people are trying different things with varied success. So World Strongest Man has always been a TV show. You know, it started
right.
on ABC in the 70s, right? And it was a spectacle. It was football players and track athletes and whatever, wrestlers. And now it's grown. So now you have this subculture that wants it now because the internet kind of
right.
does that. Now, there was some friction within the last 10 years, 15 years maybe, where they were trying to do like a blackout on information. Like, they were forbidding
yep.
people from posting results. They were trying to, and it was like, okay, grandpa, like, you're behind the times a little bit. Like, not only can you not physically do this in the era of the internet,
right?
But it doesn't benefit you at all. So the fans revolted with that. But it's like, now they've embraced that and they're like, okay, well, we can have our influencers, you know, Shaw and Eddie Hall, and everybody has their channels.
Post things.
Okay,
yep.
we can actually use that to our advantage by having them post and talk about it. But yeah, it's like, you're not going to get a fully realized package because it's still a TV show. So we still have to wait for that. And then Shaw Classic does a different thing. Shaw actually tries to impose the same thing, which puts a really bad taste in my mouth.
Really?
It's like, they always, it's like strongman guilt because there's nothing physically limiting that information from being spread around other right. than it's just like, well, you know, you would pay for the live stream if you want to know the results.
Yeah. And, like, I pay for that one every year. Cause like one, I just think I actually enjoy their live stream. It's like, I feel like it's, they had like a, I didn't watch the live stream, but this past year they had a live stream and then they kind of edited it down. And then the next day it was like a more condensed watchable version. And I really liked that. Cool. Like, I'm like, okay, yeah, that's smart. That's the thing to do.
I hear the quality is really good. Yeah, I hear the show is fantastic.
Yeah,
it's really just the insistence that if you want it, like everybody that competes has to like keep it a secret artificially until like
right.
It's weird. I understand there's a lot of businesses that operate or at least try to operate that way, but that seems so different from how sports goes in the modern era. Well, it seems very weird. It seems like a way to artificially prop up the revenue. And I get it. You want to support something that you love and is good, but yeah, it just goes to show all the different ways that people are trying to carve out, revenue from this unique type of sport.
I don't even think it would even chop up revenue. Like I think World's Strongest Man viewership, I would guess, would go up because you have these huge accounts promoting it and, hey, check out the finished product, blah, 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 blah. And then same thing here, like people who don't know anything about strongman aren't really going to follow the day-to-day event-by-event updates anyway because they don't care. But if that information's getting out there, they have a chance to hear about it. They might watch the finished product and pay $20 for it or whatever.
Yeah. I think Rogue has probably done the best to utilize the modern technology and modern ways of navigating these types of things. Their live stream is excellent. They have everything timed, so it goes off very, very quick. And it just brings in so many views every time they have the Arnold Classic, every time they have these big events. They do a true spectacle. Like they go out of their way to embrace the spectacle, which is really awesome to see. And I think they pull the best of both worlds. And at the end of the day, they have these amazing high-res clips and abbreviated, kind of condensed versions of the contest. So I think Rogue's about what the future is probably going to look like there.
Yeah, their quality and production value on anything they do is just top-notch. Like, yeah, I agree. They're definitely doing some things right. I always end up watching it on YouTube, and I always, yeah, anything that ends up there, I end up watching. World's Strongest Man's YouTube's actually getting decent, too. They're starting to put out little pieces here and there of events from, I don't know if it's 2022 or 2023, but, that's cool. Well, let's
go. It's got miles to go, man. I think it's just a matter of, you know, how are they going to handle the athletes versus how are they going to try to grow a fan base? But, you know, it'll be cool to see over the next few years.
Yeah, well, and I like that there's a little bit of competition for World's Strongest Man, too. You got Rogue doing the Invitationals and the Arnold Classic and putting out quality production value videos, almost show videos, and competition just kind of ups the game all around, you know?
Yeah, ideally. And when you get one big heavy hitter that's running away with it, and that seems to be the case, they got their hands on the biggest contest.
For sure.
Hopefully that's putting the right kind of pressure on everybody else.
Cool. Well, let's change gears a little bit. So you got a couple things going on. The thing you're probably most well known for at this point is going to be the YouTube channel. You're sitting at over 100K subscribers, which is super cool. Talk a little bit about how that got started, what brought you into that world and that kind of thing.
Sure. So I had, in the midst of training, and, I started competing for a while and I started, having direction and kind of going through my paces, and I learned just so much, and I was able to talk to so many people, and I was still learning and reading and just trying to absorb everything I could, especially for myself, for all the unique problems I had. So at that same time, I was in the process of dicking around in college, which I did for about 10 years with like an associate's degree to show for it.
They're called doctors, Tommy.
I know. I think I have like the undergrad work for like four different majors, but none of them came to fruition. I just didn't know what I wanted to do. I couldn't commit to anything. So far back as like probably 2010, 2012, somewhere around there, I mean, I was like watching courses. I was watching or reading blogs on, like, you know, how to make money online, how to sell information products, how to essentially be an educator, but yeah, use online platforms to do so. So I always had that in the back of my head, and I was picking up a bit as I went. And I did a couple false starts with blogs and stuff. I think I tried podcasting at one point, and then I picked it up again and dropped it. Every platform has its own unique thing, and right, YouTube just really hooked me. I knew I wanted to use this, like, one thing I developed some amount of authority in, and I just didn't know what that would look like. I really enjoy training, but I didn't want that to be full time.
Right.
You can get burnout on working with clients.
100%.
If that's something you're doing 10 hours a day. And I know guys that do that.
Yeah.
So it's like, what are the odds you're going to do that prep for that big show you got coming up, you know, when you have that kind of hours to clock worrying about other people's stuff. So it gets hard.
Right.
Yeah. And then, it's crazy. It feels like not that long ago, but it was about 5 years ago. I owned a gym in Redlands, California. It's a little strongman gym.
Nice.
And we had a real good crew there. And I just kind of leveraged the open space I had and the fact that there was a big whiteboard and it was frequently empty. And I just took out my shitty camera and filmed the video. And the first one I did was one of my best. I think I did it on cutting weight because there just wasn't information about how to cut weight for a show. And dude, I do big ones. I've done like 35 pounds in like a 24-hour period. And
how tall are you?
5'10". Well, after all these years of yoke loss, I'm probably like 5'9" and a half.
Dude,
but I'm going to stick with 5'10".
I always say I used to be 6'1" until I found strongman, but really I've been like 5'11" and a half the whole time.
it compresses you, certainly.
Cool. Sorry, that was random thought I had. I was like, he's got a really good press. His arms aren't that short. I bet he's short. And damn it, you're not that short.
I have a medium build. I'm not, well, you know, it's deceptive. I'm not that tall either. I get a big head. It takes up a lot of space. But I tell everybody I'm the world's fattest middleweight. You know, everybody has their IG handle, you know, world's strongest dog groomer or whatever.
Right, right.
But I compete and I do pretty well. Like I have some pretty good showings, and guys that populate the middleweights are like, they're 250, 255,
oh, crazy,
no body fat on them. And then they cut to get into the 231.
Dude, we have
and I'm watching them.
I have a gym, the gym that I own here in Lafayette, Indiana. We have two of the top 10 middleweight pro strongmen train at my gym right now. Justin Loy's there, and Tyler Pruitt are both there. And then his wife, Tyler Pruitt's wife, is also like a professional strongwoman, like lightweight or something. And the things these people, Tyler's not as big as Justin, but Justin's like 6'1 or 6'2. He walks around at like 260, competes at 231. Like, it's insane.
Yeah, it's pretty normal. And you look at some guys that really top it out. I remember like when Anthony Deal was still competing. Like I'm trying to think, some of these guys would show up when they take off their shirt, you would think there's like a physique show around just because.
Have you seen Anthony's recent pictures? He is peeled. It's crazy.
Is that right?
Because he's getting into bodybuilding now, and it's just, he looks nasty, dude.
Well, yeah, he had a pretty good base. He was very muscular and very lean, and that was kind of the prototype for the middleweights, you know, stack as much muscle as he could on a smaller frame. And, you know, that's how you top out a weight class, right? As much lean mass as you can, then cut weight, and then you're getting every ounce out of that weight class you can. I'm the exact opposite. I show up like 24% body fat. Like, I still have to do like a 35-pound cut.
Hey, that's a real strong man right there.
I know, man. I'm 5 days before my cut, I'm eating Twinkies and whatever. It's like, it'll be fine. To bring that back around, that was one of the first videos I did was how to cut weight. And it's still one of my like top three. I have almost 500 videos out.
Yeah.
And that's like still one of my top three of like all time. So once I saw the analytics and I saw it take off, I was like, that was like the encouragement I needed to keep going. And then I kept making them weekly, a couple videos a week for the last 5 years. And it's worked out great. I've been really blessed with the feedback. I think it's great that I can engage with people on this platform. And it just seems to be that if you have a way to help people solve a problem, you're going to get rewarded for it.
Yeah, 100%. And that's your channel's great too, because I mean, I feel like on Instagram it's more of an issue, but Instagram it's like, oh, here's my workout today, blah, blah, blah. No one cares about that. If you want to create value to people, you have to solve one of their problems. And your whole YouTube channel is like, hey, why should you do this instead of that? Hey, here's this tier list of things that you were wondering about. Like, it's very, you can tell you're very focused on like, essentially like what the customer would find value in, not just what you think is cool.
Completely, yeah.
Yeah, it's solid. Everyone should subscribe. It's killer. I love your channel.
I appreciate that, man. Thank you. Yeah, that's the one like valuable lesson I take out of this. It applies to every other business. I mean, you hit the nail on the head. Every business you would ever want to run, if you want to start a brick and mortar shop selling antique coins, or if you want to do something online, or even if you just want to have friends, if you want to have people that keep you around because you're worthwhile, it's like if you can help somebody solve a problem, that, I mean, that's a book, that's a course, that's a blog, and that's the one thing that you see. And again, this is kind of the weird consumer dynamic of these strength sports, which are very focused on the competitor. So a lot of the people that compete, they make the mistake on their social media. The whole thing is about them, you know? And if you're trying to grow a following, you would think this stuff is saturated. Like, you would just think, of course, there's so many people posting. If my, like, you know, kind of chubby, like, gingery, balding ass can occupy this space that has so many people that are just jacked to the tits and are incredibly strong and eloquent, knowledgeable, and whatever, that means that there's room for the space to grow. And I'm actually keep trying to like throw it out there because I do want more people coming into the space. But if you want to have an Instagram take off, if you want to have even a TikTok, if you take whatever weirdo song in those little pop-up text boxes, and if you just populate it with a short list of something that's useful to other people, your channel will explode. But people intuitively, it's, oh, here's my squats for today, or, you know, here's what I was, this random thought I had, or here's the pseudo motivation.
Yeah.
And that's just really easy. Just take practice.
It's so funny, because I think the core issue is everybody is naturally a little selfish, right? So you want to post stuff that you like and that you think is cool, but your audience is also naturally selfish and they want to consume things that are things they want to learn and they want to hear. So it's like you have to like kind of override your initial human brain of doing the things that's just the knee-jerk reaction of thing that you want to do and kind of push the other direction. And yeah, I mean, anyone that has a huge channel, and unless they're just like some hot chick showing their ass, like it's because they're doing the thing, they're giving back and pushing for what the audience wants to see, not just doing the crap they feel like doing all the time. And in the end, you'll like doing that crap too, because you'll enjoy that you're providing value to people. It's cool. I like it.
Oh yeah, it's a much more it's much more satisfying.
Yeah,
and I know, I'll even admit, like we're you're right, we're all like that. And when I hit a big lift, well, back in the days when I used to hit big lifts, I post something, sure, it's exciting. You know, it's exciting to put it up and wait for the likes to come in. You feel that dopamine rush you get, checking your phone every 5 minutes to see who commented on it now. And people get addicted to that. But after a while, it just becomes noise, because everybody's got a million lifters on their feed and they're not as attached to that lift as you are. So that's kind of thing number one, you know, it's just remember, nobody on God's green earth cares about your lifting as much as you do.
Right.
So if you are going to have a way to engage with everybody out there, you know, it's like, you don't want to be the guy at the party that walks up to everybody and just starts in the middle of a sentence about the last thought you had, because that doesn't have anything to do with the other person. So it's just the way you engage with people, you have to make that bridge, and the bridge is going to involve this massive audience you have that's watching your stuff, which means you have to appeal to them. And that's probably going to have less to do with what you think it might.
Right. 100%, man. So you have some programs on an app. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I was fortunate enough to partner with Boost Camp, which is a pretty damn cool app. They have a lot of really good programs on there. Some of them are popular and well-known. They just digitized it and threw it on there. You punch everything on in your phone, just super easy to keep track of stuff. You don't have to use a notebook. But there's also some programs on there that you won't find anywhere else, because they've been reaching out to a lot of creators. There's a lot of good good sources, good authorities in the field that have their stuff on there. So Jeffrey Verity Schofield, Cody LeFevre, who did GZCL, is up there. Bryce Lewis, who's pretty well-known powerlifting coach, right, has some programs up there. Yeah, it's a really cool resource.
So what do you run down the programs that you have on there and kind of what their target is?
So they were in the so this is kind of a weird, I don't want to shoot myself in the foot here. I'm not always the best self-promoter because I always throw a caveat and everything. It was kind of a weird journey getting myself on there because it's cool that the content should be on there. Right. But I'm trying really hard not to funnel programs out into the ether because as fun as it is to say, well, what if I do this progression instead of that one? What if I try this split instead of that one? What if I use these exercises or this rotation instead of that one? You can sit down and do that all day, and right, most people do, just for fun. The most important thing about programming, there's a lot of ways to do it, but that doesn't mean that everything flies. So whatever right, you do, it has its own learning curve, right? So there's some balance between experimentation, which is important, but also you have to stick with something, some methodology, some basic framework, some basic approach long enough to actually get good at it.
Right.
So I never wanted to have a dump of programs out there. What happened is I wrote my first book, Base Strength, which has been out for a couple of years now. And the whole thing is about kind of a general approach to strength training. And it's not conclusive. It's not,
right,
it's not like the all encompassing resource, but it has a way that I like to approach this stuff. And it goes over blocks and how to run, you know, wave your progressions and, you know, how to pivot it and what to do. And it gives you a lot of examples. And I finished by putting 10 programs in the back that were all wildly different, that looked like some of the more popular things you had seen in one point or another, and kind of break down using the principles of the book, like, hey, this is why this would make sense. This is what you could expect from this. This is what recovery is like. This is who it's probably for. And some of them became kind of popular. Now, I don't know if it's because of the name, because I just picked right, a cool name for that one. And I don't know if it was because just people really, really enjoyed the structure and it appealed to a lot of people. But I said from the start that those programs, they were examples. That doesn't mean you can't use them. In fact, a lot of people seem to have used them with pretty good results.
Right.
I'm really quick to say, like, some people might say, if you make these changes, you just know you're not running my program. And I'm like, no, no, no. Like, you take this stuff and you mold it to yourself. You're obligated to mold it to yourself until you get a good result. So the ones they digitized, they started going through that library and throwing them up on Bootcamp. They have Bull Mastiff, which is probably my most popular one. We just got one. I titled 70s Powerlifter just because it kind of had that
nice,
that kind of, you know, heavy strength focused lean with just loads of accessory work, kind of inspired by like Doug Young is a big inspiration, guys that were, you know, Kazmaier, guys that were large, very muscular, very strong, who I basically look at it like they did bodybuilding plus, you know.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of volume, very power building.
Yes, yes. And a lot of high volume with the compound. So it's like,
yep.
I mean, I think there's like bodybuilding types that'll do like their heavy strength specific work and then go, you know, machines, isolation, accessory. But then there's some of the nutcases that they'll do like 5 sets of 10 on like 4 different compound barbell movements. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah, you don't tend to see that quite as much.
No.
So it's fun to kind of play around with that stuff. And then I got a strongman, like doing strongman in a corporate gym kind of lean, like without all the equipment, what carries over the best. That's called Full Sturker, and that's available on there. And I have a program called Con, which was kind of fun to write, which is more hypertrophy focused, but it always, I mean, I train cyclically.
Yeah.
So it's more about, you know, 4 weeks to kind of get away from heavy shit, do some bodybuilding type stuff, get some blood flow in, get a little bit of hypertrophy, at the very least capacity. And then right, it tethers you back. It kind of tapers you back into the heavy work. So I think I have 4 up there at this moment.
That's awesome. Yeah, and I love the concept of your base strength. Was that an ebook at the time when you first put it out? Then
it's an ebook. Yeah, the paperback is on Amazon.
Oof, I'm gonna have to get it. I just love books where it's like, here's the principles of all of this. Here's how they can work in these things, but the principles are what matter, not the specific program. Thoughtful Pursuit of Strength was like that, that Chad Wesley Smith put out. And there's a lot of, yeah, I feel like we talked about Mike Westerling. His book's kind of like that too. And he's actually coached me through powerlifting quite a bit more than strongman. And yeah, it's just cool to see how those same principles apply regardless of what things are coming out, you know?
methods are many, principles are few.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So, and you know, right? Like the stuff we had, you know, 2 decades ago, a lot of information. There wasn't a problem with information.
Right.
But being able to draw a line from one thing you heard to something else was impossible.
Right.
Because even when it was limited to bodybuilding, there's still different schools of thought, different approaches. And I always struggled with how the hell does this fit into everything else I just read?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how am I supposed to conceptualize this? And you couldn't. It was all just individual nuggets of information and you would just piecemeal them together.
Yep. Yeah, it's crazy. I just remember I had a thing happen to me the other day where just talking about how it was just hard to fact check and connect dots and do any real concrete information gathering back in the day. Everything was essentially just rumors, right? I remember when I was in high school, you remember the band Savage Garden?
Yeah.
So I was talking to my wife the other day and I was like, yeah, you know, those guys are gay and like with each other. And she's like, what? No, I didn't know that. I'm like, well, I guess I heard it like 30 years ago, and I guess I have actually no idea if that's actually true or not. Turns out, like, that's not the case at all. But, like, dude, that's how information was back then. It was just like, well, I heard this one thing. Let's just keep spreading this rumor and say it enough that everyone thinks it's true. It's crazy.
Well, it's like, okay, it's like, what high school did you go to? You were in Indiana, right?
Yep. And I was in a very small high school.
Okay, so I graduated from Poway High in San Diego, California. What did you hear back in late 90s about Marilyn Manson? You remember that rumor?
Which rumor, I guess?
Something about a rib.
Oh, yeah, he took his rib out so he could suck his own dick. Yes.
So that was like the original chain letter.
Yes. Like, oh my God. School. It totally like, was.
Yeah, so think about that. It's kind of crazy, right? 1996, 1998, whatever. It's like, I don't even know that. Was AOL even a thing? I guess AOL was a thing, but it's like, how wild is that? No social media. And you got people across, you know, 2000 miles away across the country.
Yeah. San Diego and in Indiana. And we both knew that for a fact. We both thought that was reality. Yeah. And maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I don't know. I haven't checked since 1996.
It's not like people were broadcasting that on MTV. You know what
right.
I mean? So it's like, okay, well, what was the conduit that connected this bit of information to everybody? And it's like, everybody heard it. Everybody. So it's funny. You're right. You're absolutely right. It's all rumors. It's all secondhand information.
So fun. Oh, cool. Yeah. Well, let's get into the next segment here. I got for you is the coveted overrated, underrated segment. So I have a couple topics specific to you, and you have to say if they are overrated or underrated. You cannot split the baby. You have to fall on one side or the other. None of this caveat bullshit.
No problem with that.
All right. Underrated or overrated tier lists?
Overrated.
Oh, man, you got so many good ones, though. I love how you talk shit the whole time about how tier lists suck.
Well, there was the story behind that. I got into it with a Reddit forum because I don't spend a lot of time on Reddit, but I did an AMA a long time ago. And it was really cool when I was coming up and I engaged and I spent a lot of time like kind of responding to everything. But I ended up doing a review of a program that's pretty popular on this Reddit forum, and it wasn't a positive review. And I ended up getting just raced over the coals for it. So it started this little like kind of fake internet war where I was like, okay, guys, like, let's go. It's like somebody left some comment. I think I did one tier list. And they're like, this is just like lazy, hacky comments, like, or that's lazy, hacky content, like low value. And it is, I think it is. That's not to say it has no value, but I'm like, okay. So I did a week of just tier lists.
Hey man, I see bench press variation tier list has 82,000 views. So someone found value in it, you know?
Oh, well, likes don't always equal, or watches don't always equal value, but I see why a lot of people scam those. And I did them the most lazy way possible, too, because I was just being petty. So
it was so funny, man. I was like, this is 5 videos that are literally just trolling. Like, this is 30 minutes of my life of him just trolling, and I love it.
Yeah, that tells you more about my personality than I think anything else in this interview.
I love it. All right, overrated, underrated, 50-rep squat sets.
50-rep squat sets? Underrated. Those should be mandatory as a warm-up before every set.
So I need you guys to go on Bromley's channel here. Just search Alex Bromley on YouTube. It'll come up. And look at his 50-rep squat set video from 6 months ago. There's only 13,000 views, which tells you all you need to know about YouTube viewers. Because that is an experience that you need to watch.
Well, that was on my way. I was working up to a big number, and I got close because I committed to doing 100 repper when I hit 100,000. And I did, and I posted it, but people, I guess nobody's seeing it because people keep asking where it is. Huh. So I did that 185 for 50. I did 135 for 101 in about 5 minutes. So I was only taking one breath in between each rep. And I was working up to that. That sounds like a lot if you've never done 100 reps, but 225 for 100 is like the God tiered squat set. And I know a couple of guys who have knocked that out. So that was like the thing on my bucket list.
Oof. Do you follow Steve Tripp at all? Tall guy out of Rhode Island. He's like tall. He looks almost skinny, but his work capacity is nuts. I feel like he does shit like that all the time.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, he competes in strongman. He kind of jacked up his elbow or tricep or something at nationals. Like broke his elbow, falling with a sandbag or something. Yeah. But dude, yeah, you'd like him too. He's pretty hardcore on that stuff.
He was out of the Midwest. I competed with him probably a decade ago. Will Dinwiddie was from that area, and that guy, he was like a former Army Ranger, and he was one of the first guys I saw do it. I think his video is still up. He knocked out 225 for 100 in like a 24-hour fitness. Oof. And I want to say it was beltless, no wraps, and deep. Everyone deep, and the ability that you have potentially to be really strong and have capacity is extremely high. So I like anything that gets people out of their comfort zones. Like, oh, you know, re-racking the weight is cardio. It's like, there's a lot of people that are stronger than you and more useful. So it's like, standards a little bit higher.
And this is going to catch me some heat maybe, but I feel like the people that talk like that are just lazy as fuck. And they look like someone who thinks putting away weights is cardio.
And that's one of the reasons I'm so bitter about it is because that was me. I was influenced by that early on, man. It
catches all of us at some point.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, hey, I got strong as shit, but don't ask me to help you move because I'll gas out halfway up the stairs.
Right. Oh man, do you follow any of John Anderson, Ian Anderson's old stuff back from when? Because he did strongman.
I've seen bits of it, like the deep water training.
Yeah, stuff. I was gonna say that back in the day. That 100 rep set stuff, like that's totally his jam. I was talking with him maybe like it was like 5 years ago, He was saying basically like, yeah, people were talking about CrossFit as this new thing that was coming up. And I was like, well, shit. He goes, shit, I've been doing that, but heavy for like 20 years. Be doing like five rep max, then a drop set for like 30 and a drop set for like 50, like just crazy stuff.
Oh, there's some psychos. I mean, Jesse Marunde was an early influence.
Yeah.
I've seen him talk in person at a panel, early 2000s when he was still active, but before he passed away in 07. His crew, the Sequim crew, was known for that type of crazy ass shit, like 20 rep stone loads, doing a squat set into a set of tire flips. And that's what allowed him to do as well as he did, because statically he wasn't a monster. Mm-hmm. But back when Worlds was a little lighter and a little faster, that type of shape and conditioning allowed him to hang with some of the best guys. It's definitely something I think that people should dip their toe in the water.
And that's definitely like a piece that I feel like, I feel like there's a lot of people who start in powerlifting, at least my client wise. I have a lot of clients who started in powerlifting and then they kind of, some of them are transitioning to strongman. And that's been like the biggest wake up call. They're like, oh shit, I have to move fast. Oh shit, I have to do a lot of reps with my 5 rep max. Like things like that are a real thing in strongman.
Oh, it's really fun. And anybody that's been around it for a long time, if you've been to a handful of contests and you start to kind of become accepted into the tribe, your favorite thing to do is see people coming from other sports if they're just a little proud. Mm-hmm. Imagine like MMA has the same thing. Somebody comes in like, well, I'm, you know, a Golden Gloves boxer. And they're like, oh, okay. you know, and then the blue belt in jiu-jitsu like ties them up. But you see the same thing. You get guys that have really just insane strength coming from powerlifting.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's like your first day. It's like, okay, we're doing, you know, bag carry medleys. Or the first, okay, we're doing stone loads, but you have to do more than one rep. You actually right. have to cycle through some reps. My first experience with a training crew, the first year I started, I was fortunate enough to go train at the East West Strength. It's now East West Strength, ran by Scott Ringle. Okay. But they have like 8 pro strongmen that came out of there. Latha Engels, Casey Garrison, but that's also where Sean DeMarinis came out of.
Mm.
And he won America's Strongest Man 105, I think 4 years. So I was there on Sean's first day, and he came in as an equipped bencher. He was an equipped powerlifter.
Yeah.
And I will never forget. And the way Scott's brain works when you show up, because that guy taught me that a training crew standards are more important than anything. Standards are 10 times more important than your actual methodology. So he would not let people exist that he thought was a time suck. Or weren't willing to put in the work. So the first workout was, what is going to make you not come back?
Right.
And it was the death method. So he lived on a steep incline in Costa Mesa. We'd do a 250 farmer's walk uphill, straight into 800-pound tire flip for 8 reps, straight into a backward sled drag. Now, that's pretty run-of-the-mill for strongman, but most strongmen don't want to do that without a couple weeks of prep for it. So you can powerlift around through that. It is pretty rough. So we tossed our cookies more than a few times.
Get people in the weeds real quick.
Yeah.
Yeah. I tell you what, it was kind of cool. I don't compete a whole lot now, but I used to compete quite a bit over the last like 10, 12 years or so. And, I had a foot kind of in both worlds. I was like in powerlifting and strongman. I'd like be 12 weeks prep for a powerlifting meet. 2 weeks out, I'd be sick of powerlifting, wanting to do strongman. And then the next contest would be a strongman show 12 weeks out. I just kind of did that for years. And it was nice because you had so much peak strength work in powerlifting, but then you got back into like the heavy, but like repy work in strongman. And I feel like it helped me stay healthy for a long time. Even though I was going pretty hard, and I thought that was like a fun way to do it. And man, I think people should totally do both, because getting maximally strong is definitely going to help your strongman, but then getting all the rep work that you get in strongman is definitely going to help build your frame for powerlifting.
Oh, they complement each other insanely well.
Oh yeah.
And it's a hard question to field when people ask about training them both together, because my initial response is they should be trained together. Even if you just want to powerlift, the mistake people make is thinking that all of your work is powerlifting specific. And there's no athletic training program in the world that follows that logic.
Right.
When you're getting closer and closer to the meet, yes, you get very specific. But your off season, quote unquote, or the initial phases you run, you know, when you're 4 months, 5 months out from a meet, that's base building. That's
right.
Building capacity. That's doing density work and rep work and doing other variations that you hate and are a pain in the ass and you're not very good at. I've tried repeatedly to get powerlifters that I've had influence over that I was programming for to do things like loading or carries, things that are super easy to do. It's low tech to pick up a keg and go run it 200 feet. Nobody wants to do that. Like, that's just the one thing that's always blank. They're like, yeah, I didn't do that.
Well, and dude, so, I hate accessory work for deadlifts. I would much rather just pick up a sandbag and run for a minute and get like my whole posterior chain just done for the day. Like, it's such a time saver. I hate that people aren't wanting to do that.
Oh, and it's so productive because the beatdown isn't the same. You look at something like a Husavell carrier, like loading. I don't feel like it's highly fatiguing, highly stimulating. But I feel like the beatdown isn't quite the same. Even when I had a lot of low back issues deadlifting, I was still able to load and do front carries, do like Husavell carries for long distances. But the time under tension, under that weight, is if you draw out a ratio of how much work the muscle is doing versus how long it's doing it for, you're not going to find that coefficient in anything in the gym.
Dude,
you're
100%. Just not. Well, and
it's
also
the same with the loading.
When you're looking at unilateral work, like, who likes doing dumbbell walking lunges? No one. No one wants to do that fucking shit. Carrying a sandbag is badass, and it's unilateral work, and, you know, maybe there's some differences between it and lunges, but if you're just not going to do unilateral work like lunges because they suck and you will do some carries, you're going to get like 80% of the bang for the buck with something that you can actually stand doing. I'm all for it.
Yeah, yeah, it's just hard. You know what I mean? It's like, if that's the trade-off. If it is going to be a very, very, very effective movement that gives a lot of bang for the buck, it's probably going to be really hard.
Yeah. All right, cool. Overrated, underrated, rounding your back on a deadlift.
Oh, okay. I'm not going to give a caveat, but I need a specific. What part of the back are we talking about?
Mid and upper.
Or oh, upper. That's so when I say what am I judging? That is bad. The statement that is bad.
Or
that,
man,
people should do it.
Should people do it or should people not do it?
Mid and upper back. Should or, okay. Or I would say yeah.
So it is super underrated.
As a way to get an advantage and not potentially mess yourself up. Yeah, that's underrated.
Dude, I agree. And it's funny if y'all are watching him deadlift on any of his videos anywhere. It's kind of a bit of an optical illusion too. So you do have a little rounding in your upper and mid back, maybe a touch, but part of that is just from training strongman so much, your lower lats are so freaking huge and thick that your mid back may be straight, but it just has such a rounding to the muscle there. It's crazy.
Yeah. So my whole back went on a journey, and I put out a bracing book a while ago that I got to republish. And, I've put out a lot of stuff on that, 'cause that was a big problem I had. I had 10 years of just repeated low back injuries.
Mm-hmm.
So I know it's contentious and there's people that have, different opinions, but as far as the lower back, like, I'm not a fan around in the lower back. I don't think there's a reason to do it. I think every skill, every sport, every movement has some minimum technical standard. And I think that one's easy enough to enforce. I don't really care to get into the literature, but I know for me, my injury stemmed from, and I know this because it was the difference between getting injured every 6 months and not having any injuries over the last 6 years. It was just learning how to brace and build tension so I could support whatever position I had to get into. So if the midsection is strong, if the erectors are thick, if you're building up tension in the midsection, I think that's most of it. And that's probably going to involve you having a neutral lower back. But yeah, the mid upper back, I mean, I just don't know of anybody hurting themselves. I'm sure somebody has, but that's not usually associated with injury. And I have short little arms. Like, you see my build.
Right.
I like to think that like Rob Tierney is my spirit animal. I'm like a smaller Rob Tierney because my thumbs hang in my belt loops. So when I'm wearing a suit, like, I've racked my junk multiple times on deadlift lockouts. So getting into a good, strong position, I mean, I have to maintain posture. I have to stay braced. I can't just let myself hang to get that leverage advantage. But yeah, man, I got to pack my arms down. I got to let my shoulders hang. So when I hear cues about people like keeping their shoulder blades back or like trying to keep their entire back straight, I don't know any good deadlifters that do that. But no, my back is kind of long, and some of the meat I have in the middle of my back was an adaptation from years of just hanging on my erectors, and they thickened out to compensate. So
yep, that makes sense.
So now it helps. It helps with loading. I'm going to tell you, having that meat. And that
dude,
position.
Right. That makes actually a ton of sense too, that the shorter arm length would make a rounded upper back from a leverage standpoint way more efficient, because you can get in a better hip and low back position because you can get them lower, or at least in a more advantaged position if you have the upper background. I never thought of that. That actually makes a lot of sense. I like that. All right. Let's see. Next up, overhead press. Overrated, underrated?
Oh, underrated. Overhead press. Overhead press is more important. It is more vital as a test of strength. It is more essential to manhood than bench pressing.
More essential to manhood. I 100% agree. same page here. What is
your, I am not biased in that whatsoever.
What is your best strict overhead barbell press?
My main lift is almost always push pressing. So I train that the way people train their squat, bench, deadlift.
Gotcha.
There was a block where I was doing specifically strict pressing, trying to see if leveling that up would help my push press. And it did, but not to the degree I thought it would. So my best numbers standing out of a rack I did a 335 for a single.
Damn.
I think I did they did 315 for a triple, and I did 275 for eight. I think those are my best straight numbers. But that was all within like a 3 month period, like 6 years ago when I was drilling that into the ground.
Nice. Some big ass lifts, man. So you competed in strongman. Did you ever do any powerlifting?
I did one meet. I coached a good amount of people for meets because it's just more accessible. More people were doing that.
Right.
We have a lot of powerlifters in our gym, and I've programmed a lot of them, coached a lot of them. I did one meet. I think there's probably a fair amount of powerlifters that would consider that not very much experience, but I'm going to be honest, man. Like, I don't think powerlifting is that complicated. Everybody and their mom squats, benches, and deadlifts.
Right.
And most of the people that are the best at it, that like win the shows, are not necessarily the ones that live, eat, and breathe powerlifting.
Right.
So if you can come in with good numbers, and there's a lot of way to get those numbers good, you're going to do well in a meet. And I understand, like, there's nerves and people, you know, they want handlers.
Right.
If you're an up-and-coming powerlifter and you're going into your first meet, like, it's on you to go figure it out the way everybody else figures it out. Like, none of us had handlers in strongman. Don't burden somebody with a 9-hour day so that you can have somebody rack your knees. That's just like a pet peeve of mine. Like, you are not at Ronnie Coleman status where people follow you around and
right.
put plates on for you and wrap your knees for you and so on. That's a pet peeve of mine. There's going to be some people to take issue with that, whatever. But in Southern California, there were meets just all over the place. A lot of gyms were hosting them. We would go to Camp Pendleton every year to watch and handle our athletes. That was kind of the hub at the time.
All right. Well, how much you bench then?
Next question. So benching, I think I've done 10 overhead presses for every one bench press over my training career. I do routinely do things like close grip or like board press,
right.
whatever. I was chasing a big log press, and I was doing a lot of lockout work and a lot of dead pressing.
That makes sense.
So my best was a 475 dead press, with the bar starting about a half inch off my chest.
Dude, that's a big ass bench. Yeah. I figured you'd have a big bench if your overhead was that big. Hell yeah.
Yeah. And the overhead just kind of carried it along because that was on the back of like, that was a ton of tricep work. That was a ton of shoulder work.
Mm-hmm.
That was very little pec work. And I get the carryover because I do have stubby arms. Like I don't have very long, you know, upper arms.
Right.
So benching mechanically is a good lift for me. That's also the reason I never focused on it that much. I had to
you didn't
get,
have to.
I will say, yeah. And I will say though, there was a period where my overhead was good because I was always predisposed to being good at it. When I was sucked at everything else, I would like be pros in the overhead in like my first couple of years, but I wasn't actually strong. I'd gotten good at a push jerk, and the numbers kind of lied about how good I was. So I actually had pecs that were so weak and underdeveloped. I couldn't pick up stones. I couldn't pinch stones. I couldn't pick up sandbags. If there was a sandbag in an event, I was done. Like that was just it. And benching was actually the thing that fixed that. So people say that benching or that type of work doesn't have carry over to strongman. Having strong pecs is very important for being able to crush things, maneuver things, pick things up. But once I got it to 100%. A certain point, it was diminished returns after that.
Yeah. There's definitely a certain level of strength you need. The biggest piece on stones that I'm trying to teach new people is that squeeze the stone, crush it with your forearms. It is that chest engagement. That's a tricky thing for people to learn, especially at first. And you never think about it in strongman as playing a part, but it does. For me, a stone lift, the hardest thing is getting the damn thing off the ground. So I get that.
God, when you're slapping everything with tacky, it's physically, you know, melded into your skin.
Right.
It's like putting an epoxy on it. You can get really comfortable. There's sometimes I don't even have to squeeze that hard. I just slap my hands on, keep my elbow straight, and pull straight up, and it comes up. But when you get comfortable with that, God help you if you get into a show that has no tacky. I remember when the stone of steel was around.
Yeah.
That was a dark period for me in strongman. That was like, I was waiting out those 3 years because I knew that it wasn't going to last. Just history repeats itself. I'm like, this is not going to be around in 3 years. The whole thing exists based on its relationship with this one organization. It's going to burn out. People are going to get tired of it. They were putting it in every single show.
Every show.
And I was a abysmal. It was crazy. You'd see guys, like, I remember, like, Jeff Lee, like, a middleweight. He did, like, a 460, like, Tacculus Stone of Steel. And I'm like, that doesn't even make sense. I had days where I couldn't pick a 280.
Well, and dude, they're, like, what is they started at the end letting people use, like, tacky towels at least, so at least you got some kind of grip. But, yeah, man, stones are by far my worst event. Right now in Strongman, at least in the regional area that I'm in, there's a lot of shows that don't even have stones at all. And I'm like, oh, my God, where was this 10 years ago back when I was actually competing to be good?
I'm on the opposite side of that. It's like stones went away after so many years of trying to get good at stones.
Right.
You know, it's like, so if I'm in a normal stone, like I have a pretty good stone load. Now, you know, after 20 years right. of sticking around trying to find out how to load stones. So now it's like, I can't remember the last time there was a 5-series stone load, or I'll take a stone for reps at this point, but it's a pain in the ass for promoters to set up. So they do something else that's easier. Which is unfortunate, but that's kind of par for the course. If you're going to be a long-term strongman, you train something to finally get good at it, and the whole culture shifts, and now you're on to something else.
There was a competition. I've gone to it twice. It's in Kentucky. It's called Mega Balls. So I kind of signed up just for a shirt that says Mega Balls on it. And the last event in both those shows was a 10 stone series. Starting at, like, for heavyweights, it was like a 200 stone up to like a 400 stone, 10 of them. And both times, I did not compete in that event both times because there was a car deadlift both times. And I'm such a competitive asshole, I will, like, obliterate my back to win the car deadlift because I'm good at it, but I put myself in a shitty position, I guess. So both times I got hurt before the Mega Balls. So I guess moral of the story is I got a cool shirt that says Mega Balls on it, but I didn't have to do the stones. So it sounded like a win to me.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Learning when to hit that off switch because points are more important than a big performance. That's kind of tricky. I don't know how I feel about those types of long medleys too, because I don't like things where the first part is like a buy-in where it's like a speed bump. It's just there to slow you down. When you have a very talent pool, it makes sense because you need something for the low end guys to do, and you need to be able to separate everybody, and the better guys can fight it out at the end.
Right.
But that's you know, it's like if you need 10 stones to get to the 400 pound stone, I don't know. Maybe start a bit heavier.
Yeah.
But personal preference, personal gripe.
Personal gripe. Welcome to Strongman.
Yeah, I got opinions. Welcome to Strongman.
All right, man. Well, we're going to bring it in for a landing here. We're right at an hour. Again, this is Alex Bromley. You can check him out on Instagram. What is your Instagram handle again?
Brahmarama.
Brahmarama. Cool. And then definitely check him out on Instagram. Again, you can check me out on Instagram at strongman_Dan. And I'm on YouTube as well, but I am not searchable because I'm not famous enough. So you can just follow the links on the Instagram. And then, as always, we do have links in the description below to all of Alex's stuff, all of my stuff, and then some affiliate links. If you are looking to purchase any gym equipment and want to support the podcast, please use those links. And that was a good show. We'll catch you guys later.